Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo.
Tonight we have a show filled with news, and we also have an interview with Larry Dorman from the AFSCME Union, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Council 4 out of New Britain, Connecticut. Larry is the public affairs coordinator, and he's going to talk to us about what's going on with the union here in Connecticut and also what's happening with the health bill nationally. And we have an article that we want to read, Leo.
What was the name of it?
Oh, I don't know what the name of it was. This article talked about Obama was not telling the truth.
Liars.
Yeah.
Everyone's a liar.
That's the one.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Very, very good. Especially considering concerning Iran. And the fact that supposedly it's a nuclear threat, and it's really not true.
But what I didn't...
And it's the same kind of hype that we had before we went into Iraq.
What I liked about this other one, this one here, that one.
Yeah, we'll just go
They talk about Tony Blair and George Bush.
Let's see what this says. This is Iran's Nuclear Threat is a Lie by John Pilger.
Yep.
And this is from England, I think, in The Observer. Let's see what it says.
His latest column, The New Statesman, John Pilger, compares current drumbeating of war against Iran based on a fake nuclear threat, the manufacture of a sense of false crisis. It led to the invasion of Iraq and the deaths of 1.3 million people.
In 2001, The Observer in London published a series of reports that claimed an Iraqi connection to al-Qaeda, even describing the base in Iraq where the training of terrorists took place and the facility where anthrax was being manufactured as a weapon of mass destruction. It was all false, supplied by U.S. intelligence and Iraqi exiles. Planted stories in the British and U.S. media helped George Bush and Tony Blair to launch an illegal invasion, which caused, according to the most recent study, 1.3 million deaths. Something similar is happening over Iran. The same syncopation of government and media revelations, the same manufacture of a sense of crises. Shutdown looms with Iran over secret nuclear plant, declared The Guardian on the 26th of September. Shutdown is the theme, high noon, the clock ticking, good versus evil. Add a smooth new U.S. president who has put paid to the Bush years. An immediate echo is the notorious Guardian front page of the 22nd of May, 2007. Iran's secret plan for summer offensive to force U.S. out of Iraq. Based on unsubstantiated claims by the Pentagon, the writer Simon Tisdale presented as fact an Iranian plan to wage war on and defeat U.S. forces in Iraq by September of that year, a demonstrable falsehood in which there has been no retraction.
In fact, there were articles that I read on the air back in 2007. It was one of the first announcement was in April. And then the second, then they came again and again and again. There were about three different announcements that they were going to go to war with Iran.
Yeah.
Or Iran was going to go to war with Israel or whatever it was. It was total bogus. It was total absolute bogus bull. And they're doing it again and again and again.
The official jargon for this kind of propaganda is PSYOPs, the military term for psychological operations. In the Pentagon and Whitehall, it has become a critical component of a diplomatic and military campaign to blockade, isolate, and weaken Iran by hyping its nuclear threat, a phrase now used incessantly by Barack Obama and Gordon Brown and parroted by the BBC and other broadcasters as objective news. And it is fake. On the 16th of September, Newsweek disclosed that the major U.S. intelligence agencies had reported to the White House that Iran's nuclear status had not changed since the National Intelligence Estimate of November 2007, which stated with high confidence that Iran had halted, in 2003, the program it was alleged to have developed. The International Atomic Energy Agency has backed this time and again. The current propaganda as news derives from Obama's announcement to the U.S. that the U.S. is scrapping missiles stationed on Russia's border. This serves to cover the fact that the number of U.S. missile sites is actually expanding in Europe and the redundant missiles are being redeployed on ships. The game is to mollify Russia into joining or not obstructing the U.S. campaign against Iran. President Bush was right, said Obama, that Iran's ballistic missile program poses a significant threat to Europe and the U.S., that Iran would contemplate a suicidal attack on the U.S. as preposterous. The threat, as ever, is one way, and the world's superpower virtually ensconced on Iran's borders. Iran's crime is its independence. Having thrown out America's favorite tyrant, Shah Reza Pahlavi, Iran remains the only resource-rich Muslim state beyond U.S. control. As only Israel has a right to exist in the Middle East, the U.S. goal is to cripple the Islamic Republic. This will allow Israel to divide and dominate the region on Washington's behalf, undeterred by a confident neighbor. If any country in the world has been handed urgent cause to develop a nuclear deterrence, it is Iran. As one of the original signatories of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, Iran has been a consistent advocate of nuclear-free zone in the Middle East. In contrast, Israel has never agreed to the IAEA inspection, and its nuclear weapons plant at Dimona remains an open secret. Armed with as many as 200 active nuclear warheads, Israel deplores UN resolutions calling on it to sign the NPT, just as it deplored the recent UN report charging it with crimes against humanity in Gaza, just as it maintains a world record for violations of international law. It gets away with this because great power grants it immunity. Obama's showdown, I guess you're going to have to reload.
Okay. Obama's showdown with Iran is another agenda. On other sides of the Atlantic, the media have been tasked with preparing the public for endless war. The U.S. NATO commander, General Stanley McChrystal, said 500,000 troops will be required in Afghanistan over 5 years. According to America's NBC, the goal is control of the strategic prize of the gas and oil fields of the Caspian Sea. Central Asia, the Gulf, and Iran, in other words, Eurasia. But the war is opposed by 69% of the British public, 57% of the U.S. public, and almost every other human being. Convincing us that Iran is a new demon will not be easy. McChrystal's spurious claim that Iran is reportedly training fighters for certain Taliban groups is as desperate as Brown's pathetic echo of a line in the sand.
During the Bush years, according to the great whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, a military coup took place in the U.S., and the Pentagon is now ascendant in every area of American foreign policy. A measure of its control is the number of wars of aggression being waged simultaneously and the adoption of a first strike doctrine that has lowered the threshold on nuclear weapons together with the blurring of the distinction between nuclear and conventional weapons. All this mocks Obama's media rhetoric about a world without nuclear weapons. In fact, he is the Pentagon's most important acquisition. His acquiescence with its demand that he keep on Bush's Secretary of Defense and the arch war maker Robert Gates is unique in U.S. history. He has proved his worth with escalated wars from South Asia to the Horn of Africa. Like Bush's America, Obama's America is run by some very dangerous people. We have a right to be warned. When will those paid to keep the record straight do their job?
Yeah. Well, I've been talking about this since 07, that, you know, and everything is a fraud that they've been perpetrating against Iran. And, you know, it's just, when is it going to stop? You know, when is it going to stop? It's not going to stop until people make it stop. You know, that's the only way it's going to happen. You want to read this one?
Yeah.
Mankind Held Hostage by Satanists?
By Fritz Springmeier.
This guy here, Malcolm, he's a conspiracy guy, and a little off the wall, I think. But
how long is it?
Pretty long.
Well, maybe can we read at least part of it?
All right.
This is on the Rockefeller bloodline.
I don't think I'd go with this.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, only because it's wigged out.
Oh, okay. We won't read that one.
Yeah.
Then. Be interesting to read on your own, though.
Yeah. But
criminalizing everyone.
This is interesting. Homeland Security plans to scan air travelers' bodily functions.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I mean, we're getting sick here, guys. It's getting to be really sick.
Why do they need to do that?
I don't know. We're going to find out. So, the Homeland Security plans to scan air travelers' bodily functions. A Department of Homeland, this is by rawstory.com. A Department of Homeland Security program that tries to detect air passengers who are up to no good is rising privacy concerns, says a CNN report, which aired Tuesday. CNN's Michelle Jean Meserve described DHS's future attribute screening technology as marrying a lot of existing technology, some of it medical, to measure breathing, heart rate, blinking, fidgeting, and other body functions of passengers at airports. I saw this on the news the other night, the idea is essentially to create a remote lie detector where sensors placed at airport security screening areas would be able to monitor a passenger's physical reaction to questions being asked by screeners. Critics have likened the concept to the Department of Pre-Crime in the 2001 film Minority Report, which describes a future where persons are caught and convicted of crimes before they occur. And originally entitled Project Hostile Intent, the program was revealed by the science magazine New Science in 2007. And according to a report at the time in the UK Guardian, new devices are expected to be trialed at a handful of airports, borders, and ports of entry by 2012.
As of last year, the program was running at about 78% accuracy on malintent detection and 80% on deception, according to DHS science spokesperson John Verrico. The Guardian reported in 2007, the plans describe how systems based on video cameras, laser, light, infrared, audio recordings, and eye tracking technology are expected to scour crowds looking for unusual behavior with the aim of identifying people who should be approached and quizzed by security staff, New Science magazine reports. The project hopes to advance a security system already employed by the U.S. Transportation Security Administration that monitors people for unintentional facial twitches called microexpressions. This can suggest someone is lying or trying to conceal information. Questions remain, however, as to how secure the system is. The machines could reveal health conditions like heart murmurs and breathing problems, as well as stress levels, which would be an invasion of privacy. It is an invasion of privacy, Jay Stanley, Director of Public Education for the ACLU Technology and Liberty Program, told CNN. Nobody has the right to look at my intimate body functions, my heart rate, my breathing from afar. As Meserve noted, some experts are doubtful that the system can distinguish between potential terrorists and people stressed for other reasons like a late flight.
Yeah. So anyway, that's for real. It's bullshit. But that's what's happening, folks. It's out there. You have to know that. To drink.
Oh, how about nine reasons why you shouldn't let your child get the flu vaccine? I think we've done that.
Where is that?
Right there. Oh, it's on a video.
You can play it.
Okay.
Only 3 minutes.
All right, yeah.
I'm going to play this. It's do not let your child get flu vaccine, nine reasons why. This year is the most important that you protect your children and loved ones from the flu vaccine than the influenza itself. This article on Lou Rockwell discusses how.
No, you're going to the written part.
No. Oh, am I going?
Okay.
It's a little,
We are tracking H1N1, and health officials here in the U.S. saying it's too soon to know if a one-shot vaccine for the virus will actually be effective. The U.S. is working on a regulation that requires two doses, although China and Switzerland recently announced they may have a one-dose version. We're told American officials will release their initial results from its vaccination studies and testing later this month. With me now, Dr. Kent Holthorst, who is an expert on infectious diseases. Doctor, thanks very much. We're going to put up on the screen the classic H1N1 symptoms, and I got this from the WHO and the CDC. If anybody exhibits these symptoms, what should they do? Should they go to the hospital? Should they see their doctor? What?
Well, the nice thing is it's showing that the H1N1 virus is losing its virulence. So we saw this as it came through Mexico. It lost its virulence in that the symptoms were much more mild. And that's what seems to be happening as it's making its way back through as a seasonal flu. So basically, the recommendations are same as the seasonal flu. If you have continual fever for more than 3 hours, call your physician. If you have recurrence of fever after it goes away, if you have a high risk, including small children, consider calling your physician. If you do have, let's say, a kid turns blue, has blue fingernails, go to the emergency room. But there's no difference between who to take to the emergency room or to the doctor versus a seasonal versus the swine flu. In fact, if you had to choose, you'd probably choose at this point the swine flu over the regular seasonal flu.
Is that right? All right. Now, what do you think of the vaccination?
You know, I have more concern about the vaccine than I do about the swine flu. It's been rushed to market. There are high levels of adjuncts, which basically make it more potent, make so they can it's kind of an unrefined method that they use. They had to use high levels of these adjuncts, including
thimerosal. It's an antiseptic preservative, and hasn't that been linked in some cases to autism?
It has, and you look at it's been shown to cause autism in children with mitochondrial dysfunction. Now, and other is controversial, though highly implicated. And the problem is you don't know if your child has mitochondrial dysfunction. I also worry about children and people who have blood-brain barrier dysfunction or it's not fully developed, which include children, pregnant women, chronic neurological illnesses, and chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia. I've seen people have been devastated by these infections.
All right, would you give it to your kids?
Infections. I definitely would not.
You would not, all right? And in fairness, I've talked to three doctors in 3 days now, and all three have said absolutely they would give it to their kids. They intend to give it to their kids. They're going to take it themselves, but you say no.
I definitely would not. I've seen it devastate people with chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, highly implicated, again, in autism. I think you're rolling the dice. It's a proven neurotoxin. It has 25,000 times the level of mercury than would be considered toxic if it was a food or a water. And levels get up, serum levels up to 100 times the toxic level. It's too big of a risk.
All right. Dr. Kent Holthorst, an expert on infectious diseases. That's the other side. We've heard both sides now. Thank you so much.
Hey, you heard it there, an expert. Absolutely amazing. Three doctors there would give it to their kids, even though it's loaded with autism-causing mercury. Unbelievable,
pretty
folks.
Scary, I think.
Yeah, people are just morons, man. In the medical profession, got to be the bigger morons. I mean, to infect their own kids.
Well, I think it's very difficult for people. They've been sort of put in the middle of a battle, and they don't know who to believe. It makes it very difficult.
Well, here's something kind of interesting. That's why. I'd like to get rid of Microsoft, quite honestly, because I really don't like what they're doing. If it says Windows 7 will let Microsoft track your every move.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's great, isn't it? Let's see. And you go to Windows7Sins.org and tell you more about what's going on. But from Fire Eagle to iPhone...
I don't know what Fire Eagle is.
I don't know either, but we'll figure this one out. Must be another thing. From Fire Eagle to iPhone apps that use your current location, everyone is racing to get on. Win7, the GeoAware software bandwagon. So far, most GeoAware
features
have been opt-in and offer reasonable privacy controls. In other words, it tells you exactly where you are.
Mm-hmm.
If Fire Eagle is a good example of this. But Microsoft's upcoming Windows 7 plans to offer developers location tools at the operating system level, and the company doesn't seem to think users care about control or privacy. Before you freak out at the thought that Redmond will soon be tracking your every move, keep in mind that the new features will be disabled by default. That's the good news. The bad news is that if you turn the geo features on, there are very few controls available, and yes, Microsoft could easily track your every move. Now you can freak out. According to CNET, which saw a demo of the new geo features, once the service is turned on, there are only two means of limiting the geo tracking. You can either limit to a specific user, or you can limit to just traditional applications, rather than services running in the background. But here's the essential problem. If you enable the geo tracking, for say, a restaurant searching app in your gadgets collection, I don't understand that. If you enable the geo tracking, for say, a restaurant searching app in your gadgets collection, there's no way to stop other apps from accessing your locations as well. It's an all-or-nothing feature. While geo-aware locations are certain a hot item in the software world right now, they're also at the heart of many ongoing privacy debates. Unfortunately, Microsoft's new feature is exactly the sort of thing that turns people's mild suspicions into full-raging paranoia. Here's Microsoft's explanation for why geo-tracking will not offer much control. It's also the paranoid's greatest fear in a nutshell. The reason Microsoft's officials say is that Windows does have a reliable means of determining that an application is what it says it is. So any attempt to limit the location to the specific application would be easily spoofable. So the short story is that Windows 7 has geo-tracking features, but aside from turning them on and off, they have basically no control. That strikes us as a recipe for disaster and something that will eventually blow up Microsoft's face, whether justified or not, because geo-trafficking is a very sensitive issue, and this implementation seems entirely ham-fisted and ill-conceived. Of course, it is a little better than past attempts by the company, which don't even offer an on-off switch. But why, for the love of all the things sane, would Microsoft not at least offer to notify you when an app is trying to access geo information? Indeed, that would be a good start. Then add the ability to deny the application access, and you're getting to the useful stage. Unfortunately, Microsoft's reps tell CNET that such controls are not currently on Microsoft's roadmap for Windows. It is totally insane. I mean, why would you want this feature? Why would you even consider it?
It's geo-trafficking. It's for when you're in the city. Geo-trafficking.
No, I understand that, but this is on your little iPods and shit. You know, iPhones and crap like that.
A lot of people have them because...
But then... Microsoft or whoever, and Microsoft is actually it was founded by Gates, but was funded by the CIA.
Yeah.
And Vista, their great plan, Vista, which I don't have and never want to see, all right, it was created by the CIA in cahoots with Microsoft.
Yeah.
Okay, so they could track every damn thing and everything in the net. And now,
they're getting
Obama,
at you this way.
And now Obama has just been given the authority by the FCC to close down the internet if there's a cyber attack.
Well,
how the hell are we going to know there's a cyber attack?
We don't know.
The government.
It's being made up.
Of course it is. Just like the war in Iran.
And the war in Iraq.
Yeah. So the whole thing sucks, and we're in for a serious problem.
So don't count on health care because it's all spent on dynasty building.
Forget
about it. Well, or if we do, it'll be so taxed, it'll be worse than what we don't have.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. This is a good article. I don't know if you're interested. Let's
The power of consciousness.
That was what it was.
The demise of the dollar. I think we read a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was from yesterday. We read that. I think I'm going to go to our interview.
Okay.
What do you think?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. I think most of this news is what we
Oh, here's
yesterday.
Another one.
People should need
minutes.
A license to drink, says prospective labor MP.
U.S. concedes economic
independence
to IMF.
Oh, this should be interesting.
Yeah, so this is a little YouTube video here, but...
just put it on.
Yeah, so we're going to run this one, and then we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Dick Morris. Last week, something happened that was almost not covered at all by the media. The International Monetary Fund, the IMF, walked off with America's economic sovereignty. We literally took a gigantic step toward global governance and toward global control by global economists of our monetary and financial and regulatory system. It was incredibly alarming. For those who were concerned by the chapter in our book, Catastrophe, the Declaration of Independence has been repealed, and there are about 100,000 people that watched a video that I did on that earlier this year. This was a terrible, terrible reversal of the G20 summit. Literally, what's going to happen now is that the professional economists around the world, run by the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, are going to work with the G20 nations to formulate plans for each of their economies and give them specific mandates and specific requirements. And by consensus, the G20 will adopt it. And, of course, the United States will participate as one out of 20 votes and basically be forced to go along with the global consensus. Then every 3 months, the United States is going to have to come back to G20 and the IMF and show that we've been good boys and girls, that we've done okay, that we've done our homework, that we've met our assignments. And if we don't, they're going to issue a negative report and rely at the moment on, quote, moral suasion, unquote, to restrain us or to move us in the right direction. But some people are even talking about toughening it to include sanctions. And once you go down that road, you're talking about really a command economy. And who are these people who are going to be running our country, who are going to be running our economic system? Well, the G7, which was the original group, was a good thing to do. I mean, the U.S. and Japan and Germany and France and Britain needed to get together and coordinate their economic policies. And okay, so Italy snuck in. And then sometimes they added Russia for diplomatic purposes. That was all fine. But to expand it now to all these other countries is absurd. And who are these other countries? I mean, obviously you needed to include India and China. But beyond that, Argentina defaulted on its debt to the IMF. They're sitting in judgment of us. Brazil, that's run by a Marxist. Mexico, that has a huge drug problem infesting the country. Good president, but a terrible problems in the country. South Africa, one of the most corrupt regimes in the world. Saudi Arabia, the single most repressive regime in the world. Indonesia, incredibly unstable. South Korea, a functioning democracy for about 12 years. Australia. I mean, those are the countries that are going to be sitting on judgment on the United States. And the IMF will orchestrate all of it. Now, the IMF has had the world's worst record, literally, in propping up currencies that have gotten into trouble in the third world, because what they always do is they always come in and say, we recommend cuts and austerity and limit wage increases and all of that. And frankly, the IMF has caused more revolutions throughout the world than Marx, Engels, and Lenin combined, and they just never learn. But now these characters are going to be sitting on in judgment on the United States. Now, we agreed to three things at this G20 summit substantively. One, reduce the deficit, which is the good news, but Obama won't heed it. Second, to increase regulations of the financial sector. And thirdly, to abide by global consensus on compensation for employees at banks and financial institutions. So basically, we've taken many of the powers of the Federal Reserve Board and the Treasury and ceded them to the IMF and to the G20. Now, theoretically, we could always veto those regulations and always refuse to apply them, but then you'd have us being the odd man out. And very soon, I'm sure they're going to extend this to climate change and various perceptions of human rights, perhaps on the death penalty, on abortion, on a whole range of issues, and we will have de facto global government. Now, my big problem with global government is that it's not democracy. You have China, you have Russia, you have Saudi Arabia that are dictatorial, autocratic, monarchic regimes. And the bureaucrats that run the IMF are never elected by anybody, and the central bankers in each of these countries are appointed by the presidents for terms but are not politically accountable. And you really have bureaucratization taking over from democracy. And that's a theme we'll be talking about more and more over the next couple of months and year. That ultimately, our new book is going to be a lot about that, that the enemy of democracy is not fascism, not communism,
bureaucracy,
not even terrorism. It is bureaucracy. It is the we know better than you crowd that
yeah.
tell us what to do. And Barack
right.
Obama gave away the store at that G20 summit, and it's going to be very hard to get it back. Thanks very much.
That's a scary thought.
Well,
he's right, though.
I don't even like him. I don't like Dick Morris either, but I,
but
you know,
I have to agree with him. I really do.
If we did that, then we deserve. You don't deserve it. I mean, we just got sold down the toilet. Sold down.
Well, it sounds like this body is taking over the job of the Federal Reserve, which is even further removed. We'll have absolutely
no control over anything.
And no ability to get our money back.
At least the president appoints the Federal Reserve chairman, which is a joke. But I mean, it's like, but he has no.
Well, see, the Federal Reserve was in jeopardy of being crushed in this country. And it will be. Yeah, and that's why they've moved
to
this.
Well, so now they've moved over to this, which is worse.
Which, you know, they've just taken
even
it one
worse.
Step further
yeah.
away.
Even worse. It's unbelievable. So, anyway, that's...
And obviously the Congress didn't vote for it. It was a presidential act, like all these things.
Well, what?
The Congress didn't make these decisions.
No. There's a presidential fast-track act by at a summit. And
he shouldn't be allowed to do that.
No, of course not.
I don't know presidents are not supposed to make these kinds of decisions.
No, these decisions are supposed to be made by Congress and not by the president. I mean, the president
actually, he has no right to make any decisions involving foreign affairs.
I don't think so. So all we got to do is just say, hey, this bastard doesn't have any right to get us into this jam. Let's get us out, you know. And Congress has every right to get them out. But Congress is a bunch of assholes. They're just a bunch of wimps. They don't even know about this. You know?
No, they're too busy cashing their checks for the big farmer.
We're about health care now.
Yeah, they're not worried about health care. It's never going to get passed.
So what we're going to do is we're going to go to our interview with Larry Dorn. It was a good interview. It was fun. Larry's always interesting. And hope you enjoy it. And... we'll be back right after that. It's about a half an hour. And absolutely amazing. We got problems, huh, Lena?
Worse than what I thought.
Yeah.
So that's what this healthcare has been, a distraction away from these summits.
That's what it is, huh? Sounds like it, huh?
Now
where this guy comes out with this stuff, and now everybody's going to be open to this and understand, what did we just do? And then, now you got the war with Iran again coming up, and then you got the war, you know, you got the war in Afghanistan and so on. So everything looks like a distraction.
Americans don't have to worry about health care. They're not going to
Yeah. If we do, it'll be such a watered-down version. It'll be just worse. It'll be worse than what we got already, which is nothing. So here we go. This is Larry Dorn.
They're going to, at Central Connecticut State University, they're sponsoring a forum Thursday to discuss some possible answers to health care. So that will be good, and I hope people get to that. We'll find out the time and everything, and I think Larry is with us. Hey, Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys, great to be here. How are you all doing?
Oh, we're doing just fine. I just read a little bit from your Council for News Digest, and You mentioned that some of the insurance companies, Aetna, Connecticut, HealthNet, Anthem, United Health Group, and WellCare, the Attorney General is looking into investigating some company abuses. What kind of abuses do you think they're guilty of? Where do you start?
Where do I begin? Seriously, there's several issues that we have concerns with, and it starts with the fact that the insurance companies are spending roughly $640,000 a day in lobbying, and that's coming from premium that's directly out of
premium
shares.
Yeah.
You know, we pay insurance premiums, and insurance companies are taking that those dollars, or some portion of those dollars, and obviously spending them on
lobbying against us,
denying benefits.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole menu of things that are going on that you know, we were troubled by. We had a protest a couple weeks ago at Aetna Insurance in Hartford, and we're going to have another one at United Healthcare in Hartford because we're saying that's the scene of the crime, that these companies are not disclosing what they're telling their members, what they're telling their insured clients about healthcare reform. Now, you asked me about the Attorney General, and he's looking at the lack of disclosure, and I think what triggered it was the fact that the Humana Insurance Company or insurance provider was providing misleading and scaremongering information to Medicare Advantage and Medicare Part D customers about what healthcare would do to them. So the AFL-CIO, the National AFL-CIO, has called for an investigation into the, you know, into holding these companies accountable, and contacted Connecticut's insurance commissioner, Thomas Sullivan, to specifically look at how and what health insurance companies are spending on lobbying. Because what we're afraid of, what the fear is that their lobbying costs are in essence being transferred to consumers through excessive rate increases. You know, Anthem just for instance got they asked for 32% rate increase, they got 20.
Mm-hmm.
The insurance commission is fairly much a subsidiary of the insurance industry in Connecticut. So you've got that problem, and then, as I say, you've got the problem of insurance companies essentially providing misleading information about health care reform. So this craziness has to stop.
Well, good. I'm glad somebody's thinking about cracking down on them. And the other issue that I know Leo and I were interested in is also the what's happening at the Connecticut, at the Red Cross. And has that problem been settled where they were using
unfortunately, it hasn't. It's really good timing that we're talking this week. We are going to be releasing, we have a national coalition of Red Cross workers, and we're going to be releasing a national report this Thursday about how the Red Cross treats its workers and what impact that treatment has on donors and on blood safety. And we'll have a Connecticut worker from our AFSCME bargaining unit featured in the narrative. It's a story being written by former labor reporter Philip Dine from St. Louis, and it's going to be a national impact story with some Connecticut focus. But the Red Cross is not simply a question of refusing to come to the table and bargaining a fair contract with the workers. We're calling them out for putting donors and putting workers at risk. And as you guys are aware from our website at council4.org, and if your listeners aren't aware, I would urge them to go there. The Department of Public Health is investigating the Red Cross, which has now suspended a particular blood platelet separation procedure due to the fact that they're not using, they're using unlicensed personnel. And we've maintained that it should be done by licensed medical personnel. The Red Cross won't train their registered nurses or won't allow their registered nurses to perform this procedure, and yet will hold them liable if something went wrong.
Nice.
It's kind of scary stuff.
Yeah, this is just...
company is so driven by profit, and they sell blood for tremendous profit. They sell it to hospitals and healthcare institutions.
That's right, and they get it for nothing.
The company is... so obsessed with chasing the dollar and with having an assembly line approach of interchangeable disposable workers that they would put people at risk, and that's what we're afraid they're doing.
Now, is this a unique problem to Connecticut, or does that happen in other states?
We've come to find out that it's a nationwide problem, and it obviously arose out of the fact that we have had a labor dispute here in state. And the more we've learned and the more we started to reach out and talk to other unionized Red Cross workers, we discovered that, lo and behold, they were encountering similar problems with the employer, either having difficulty bargaining new contracts, fighting the employer, the Red Cross, on procedures that it's trying to change. Such as in other states, they want the driver technicians to be able to stick needles in your arm to take out blood. So we found a whole much deeper layer of conflict and problems in this organization. So unfortunately, it's not just Connecticut, it's nationwide. And that's why we have the National Red Cross Workers Coalition. And it's a coalition that's for, out there for blood safety.
Yeah, I hope we can make some progress in that area.
You know, that would be good. We're bracing for a very long fight, to be quite honest, and I'll absolutely keep you posted. But again, I would urge people to get to our website and get the latest news on what's happening, and people just need to keep in mind what this company is really about.
And we can't compromise the health and safety of the public. That just can't happen. And people need to be fairly compensated for what they do.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I appreciate that you're bringing up our Red Cross workers' struggle, because when you think about it, I mean, it really sort of echoes this larger discussion and debate we're having about our healthcare system.
Right.
Which is, you know, and we're dealing with a system that really puts profits ahead of people. You know, it's a system in which getting treatment and getting care is called a medical loss.
Yeah.
The loss is what takes away from the profits, the multi-million-dollar salaries of these executives. So, you know, just getting back to what we opened the show to discuss, this is one of the fundamental problems, bar none, facing everyday average Americans.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Senate Finance Committee debate of the amendments to health reform bill, that they want to put an excise tax on people's health plans. What is the position right now on that?
35%.
Is that right?
It's absolutely insanity. Where are they coming up with this stuff?
Well, you know, I don't know where they're coming up with it, and I think the problem is that absent the willingness to fight for a public option, a competitive mechanism to hold insurance companies accountable, I think that the Finance Committee members and the Democratic majority on that committee are kind of grasping at makeshift solutions, and one of them is to tax the benefit, and that would be very devastating to middle-class workers.
What's his name? The chairman of that board, that committee, was noted as having getting over $3 million from the insurance companies in campaign donations. $3 million.
Yep.
Right. And what's his name?
Bacchus.
Yeah.
Bacchus. It's a problem. You know. And look, I think that as I try to assess this situation and be realistic and, you know, sober-minded about it, I think that there is such skittishness about championing and fighting tenaciously for the public option and for an employer mandate that what happens instead is that we end up, and then fueled by, as you just noted, the corporate lobbyist donations, campaign donations, I think what happens is we end up with plans that would tax benefits, you know, middle class and middle and lower wage earners. This will do nothing to reform the system. It will take more money out of the pockets of people who do have health care and can barely afford it to begin with and are paying a lot already. So, again, you know, the question is, are we getting closer to health care reform, or are we dragging out the process and getting further away from the goals?
It seems to me that
affordable, accessible health insurance for every American.
Yeah, it seems to me that the middle class or average American that gets some health care benefits, he'll be taxed by the government and he'll pay huge premiums to the employer for it.
Exactly.
So what is this?
You know, it never ceases to astound me how everyday working people end up being asked to foot the bill for a problem they didn't create. And
right.
Fortunately, this thing hasn't gone through yet. It may not go through, but I certainly would urge people to contact their congresspeople, particularly Senators Dodd and Lieberman, and tell them to do something. Tell them to support a public option. And tell them to do the right thing. We're doing that. We're generating thousands and thousands of letters and calls across the country. We want a public option, and we don't want to see workers' health benefits taxed. It's just ludicrous that these things come up.
And is Dodd backing away from the public option? Is he backed away now?
Dodd?
Yeah.
I would not say that he's backed away from it. I think that of the two senators, the more problematic one is Joe Lieberman, who has publicly said that Lieberman has publicly said that the debate over the public option is what's killing or stopping health care reform, which is, a little bit daft, but he's enthralled to the insurance companies, so.
Yeah. And if we don't have a public option.
Junior senator.
Yeah.
So I don't understand it all, but I the first thing I thought of when I heard this 35% tax on Cadillac insurance premium insurance policies was the Senate and Congress. Okay, the insurance policies they have that are given to them, okay, by us. Now they should be taxed for that. If they're going to come in with that, they shouldn't be exempt. All right, but for these taxes, should they be?
Well, of course.
But
they make so much more money than the average.
No, that's the problem.
It's nothing.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, Lila hit it on the head. I mean, that's not the rhetorical. I share your frustration, Leo. It's just that's not the argument I want to employ because they can't afford to be taxed, and so the issue isn't taxing plans that are available to middle class workers. The issue is having the challenge is to legislate meaningful, comprehensive health care reform that doesn't tax benefits, that has a public option, that controls costs, that provides guaranteed coverage, that holds insurance companies accountable, and puts into motion a pay-or-play system for employers so that we take the, we kind of start to move away from the shackles of an employer-based healthcare system.
Yeah.
So, that's kind of where I see it. But so rather than talk about shouldn't Congress, they can afford to pay, they can afford a tax on their benefits. I would rather say that every American should have the kind of healthcare that our members of Congress get via the courtesy of the American taxpayer. That's how I frame it.
Yeah, and I think we should all be on the same plan.
Yeah, open
and
their
that's
plan
it.
Up to every American.
Because
let's stop this nonsense.
Yeah.
Just set up a system, call it single payer, call it whatever you want. The goal isn't to put private insurance companies out of business. The goal is to hold them accountable. If the system is run amok and the executives are making boatloads of money and more people are losing coverage or have wholly and totally inadequate insurance. So wouldn't you like to have the plan that Senator Lieberman has?
I certainly would, and I'd like to see us. I don't want to hear how we can't afford it. What I want to hear is we can't afford it, and we're going to stop going to war, and that's why we will. And, if we weren't fighting in Iraq and Iran, maybe we could have some money to take care of our own people.
Afghanistan, and we just read a couple articles that they want to go into Iran.
Yeah, that's the next.
These people are out of their minds, Larry. They're just completely out of their minds.
I get the frustration, Leo. I hear it loud and clear. I know you and I talked briefly on the phone this afternoon.
How do you rate, if you were going to rate the Obama administration for the last 9 months?
We had the Saturday Night Live version. What did you think about that?
Right.
We're putting you on the spot. I know.
No. It's a fair question. I think that I'm somewhere around. If you're asking me to grade them, grade him rather, grade his administration. I have to give him at least a B because he's raised really important issues like health care reform, like our broken financial system, and and elevated the discourse, the national discourse about those issues, and there's tremendous value in that. I think that appointing or nominating, I should say, Sonia Sotomayor was an excellent move, and we're going to see one or two more vacancies on that Supreme Court. That's very important. I think that, you know, some of the subtle stuff that people will see every day, he's actually appointing agency heads that believe in the mission of their agencies, whether it's to protect workers' rights or protect the environment or strengthen public education. We actually have...
He's hired guys, and some of these czars that he's hired. I mean, the science czar is a devout eugenicist. All right. These other czars, one just had to back away. One just left because of his tax problems. All right. Another guy. I mean, when you look at his cabinet, I mean, all he's got in there are Goldman Sachs and former.
We were a bit disappointed at some of his
guys.
His appointments
are really pathetic.
Not all. I mean, that's what I'm trying to say. I mean, there are many people, particularly.
Name one of them that's a good appointment. No, I mean, well, Sotomayor, I gave her about a C.
That's right. The Supreme Court.
But to anybody else.
Yeah, you know, Arnie Duncan in education, you know, the labor chief. There are many agencies where I think he's made wise appointments.
You think Geithner was a good appointment?
Well, I think that Geithner... I understand that there's a lot of that. He's something of a lightning rod because he comes, you know, he's a product of that very industry that got us into a boatload of trouble. So I'm not pleased with him so far, of course not. But again, I keep trying to step back and say that if McCain had been elected, we would be in so much worse shape. I want Obama to be bolder? Yes. Do I want Obama to free himself of the shackles of the Wall Street greed heads? Yes. I think that there are things that could be done better, but again, the fact that we have a president who's actually trying to elevate the national discussion about issues like health care reform and wage and gender inequity, I think that's very valuable, very important, and you know, and I think that after 9 months, I'm not going to rush to judgment and say this thing is you know, a failure, that he's let us down, because he has, and you know, it's a hell of a job in front of him, and we also have to remember that he just inherited a gargantuan mess that the Republican Congress and former Republican president created, including you know, the misbegotten adventures out of the Middle East that are killing our young people and costing trillions of dollars.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, we voted on a Democratic Congress in 2006 that did absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Okay, nothing.
Yeah. You know,
nada, man. It was the saddest thing I ever saw. And then, I mean, the first thing she said is, we're not going to impeach Bush. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, they should have impeached her, you know, after that. It was horrible.
Well, I have to admit that was a real disappointment to
and
me.
Everything they did was a disappointment.
I think when you see criminal behavior in government, yeah, you have to address it. You can't make that the elephant in the room.
You know, we are in such a mess,
aren't we?
In this country, and you know, it's not fixable in 9 months.
That's right.
What disappoints me, I suppose, when I reflect on it, is that when Bush and you know, the nut jobs like Tom DeLay,
Dancing with the Stars. Have you seen them?
But when they were,
disgusting.
And then Mitch McConnell. You know, when the Republicans, you know, were in control, they refused to acknowledge the opposition. They steamrolled and put very bad, harmful policies into place. And I think, you know, unfortunately, and maybe it's a tribute to their high-mindedness or their fairness. And their search for wisdom, that the Democratic majority isn't behaving that way. But my fear is that they are squandering an opportunity. So this is dirty stuff, and sometimes you just have to kind of steamroll people in order to get good legislation through. You've got a majority. And obviously, healthcare is an example. the Democrats have stopped dithering.
They got to pass it.
Comprehensive reform and put it through.
Why is he so concerned about appeasing the Republicans? But he knows he's going to get nothing from the Republicans.
Yep. I can't figure that piece of it out. I really can't. You know, it's sort of inexplicable to me. And, you know, I
just think it's another example of the spinelessness of their Democratic Party. You know, they have the majority, they need to exercise it on their own. And then when they lay back, then what happens is they get mauled by the Republicans.
They're merciless.
Yeah, I mean they draw blood anytime they speak. I mean, and rightfully so.
Right.
I mean, rightfully so. The Democrats, they got the House, they got the Senate, they got the presidency, but they're doing absolutely nothing, and they're kowtowing to the Republicans, for crying out loud.
That's why when you ask me, how do you rate Obama after 9 months? You know, part of the discussion does have to reflect the fact that I don't think he's getting the full cooperation that he could be getting from.
Yeah.
Congress, they're not helping, as they say.
He should have come in with a stick, and just started beating on people. That's what I would have done.
I think the biggest problem, Leo, is that
Pelosi in the woodshed there, and all of her minions, all right, and started beating on him.
The problem was that he is unlike Lyndon Johnson, who because he was an insider. He knew where all the skeletons were, and he could really arm twist people and get his legislation passed.
Right.
Let's face it, Obama was a political outsider to that system, and he'd only been there a short time. I mean, he virtually came from nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
We saw him at the Democratic convention.
Well, he was a made man.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Like Kennedy, he was a made man. That was the road he was going to take.
But
boom, boom.
He didn't have that personal experience that Lyndon Johnson did when he passed all these wonderful, social programs. So that's the difference. He doesn't have that experience.
Well, but again, even if he, I think he's a fairly forceful and principled individual. But when you've got he's not there alongside congressional leadership, and when they're the ones going slowly or compromising on legislation, it makes things difficult for him. But
and he lost Ted Kennedy.
Try to step back, look at the bigger picture, look at the god awful state of this country that Bush and the Republicans left for all of us and for Obama. And there's a part of me that is thankful that McCain isn't president, because we'd be in a hell of a lot worse.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Oh boy, I just shudder to think about that.
I don't know how much worse we could be in, but man.
I'm sure he could have made it worse.
Yeah. But I have my real question though is if Obama succeeds in anything, what do you think will be successful to him? What do you think will be that right now?
I think that again, if he is successful in economic inequity, getting people back to work, and having pushing through meaningful health care reform, which is absolutely part of that larger debate about the economy, I think that's how we ultimately will measure his impact.
I think so.
And obviously, I think also how he handles the Middle East. We can't have our heads in the sand and just say that it's all about the economy and health care, because what's going on in the Middle East is such a drain on lives and on resources that can be used to fight domestic battles. I do think he'll be judged on that, just as I think Kennedy and Johnson were had to be judged harshly about Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think was their... I forgot my question, actually.
I mean, Nixon was horrendous when it came to escalating bombing and deepening American involvement. But, I think what's happening in the Middle East is going to end up tainting and has tainted both parties.
Yeah, I mean, why do you think he didn't talk to his generals for the last 2 months?
That was an odd thing.
Did you hear about that? McCluskey, was it McCluskey or McClutchy? But anyway, he said he hadn't talked to this guy, to the president, in over 70 days.
There are so many balls in the air. I mean, I don't totally buy into the fact that he's ignoring or not paying attention to this issue. I just think that there's such a front burner focus on reviving the economy and fixing the broken healthcare system and dealing with the Wall Street excesses and putting through a stimulus package. How much can a person do?
The problem is those guys are dying over there. They just blew up 10 more guys yesterday.
No doubt about it. Sadly, it's off the radar screen.
Yeah.
You know, Bush made this a priority, so we heard about it all the time. And Obama has made the economy and the health care reform a priority, so I think that we have much more of a debate going on in this country about that. And
it's still the war. I mean,
the lack of progress in extricating ourselves from Iraq and Afghanistan and extricating ourselves from fixing some of the problems, or at least trying to foster some kind of solution to some of the mayhem and bloodshed in the Middle East. But I'm not naive. I understand that. I think ultimately we can't get the economy and get the country moving until we fully, unless we figure out how to do that process, engage in that extrication. And maybe we can. I don't know. Way smarter people than I are dealing with this.
Hey, don't count on that. You know, don't even think that, Larry.
Yeah, I know. Interesting that it's kind of like middle and back page stuff.
Yeah, I kind of wish we could run you for office there, Paul. You're light years.
Bush made the Middle East his cause, bar none, and so the economy fell apart. Katrina ripped through New Orleans. The Wall Street greed did. So Bush just completely screwed this country up. And then because he made the war such a prominent piece of his administration, the war on terror, that he came to be judged by that as well as by what he failed to do in the economy. I'm not suggesting that Obama has inverted that strategy, but obviously look at the papers, listen to talk radio. The debate is about health care. Sometimes Afghanistan pops up, but I think we're...
You don't hear any more about Iraq.
Go do a search on the number, do a Google search on Iraq and compare it to health care reform and see what you get. And I understand that. You know, that's not begrudging that or saying that's a bad thing or a good thing. It's just the reality in which we live right now.
That's crazy. But I want to thank you for being on there.
Oh, it was fantastic. I love talking with you, too.
Lyle,
Leo, keep up the fight.
We do.
Let's talk next month.
Right.
We'll be glad to do that.
Yeah.
And do you have anything going on right now in Hartford that you need to tell people about that they could come to?
If listeners are interested, because even if they can't attend, there are a lot of healthcare rallies and events in Connecticut. You can check out council4.org. And this Thursday, for example, when we're in downtown Hartford declaring United Healthcare the scene of the crime, we've got some events coming up later in the week. And also one, I know we didn't get a chance to talk about it, but I would urge your listeners to follow the less sexy battle going on in our own state capitol about implementing the budget, funding agencies like the judiciary branch. There's a lot of stuff going on here in state. There's a projected $500 million deficit coming up, according to the comptroller. So we may be looking at a continuation of the fights that we've been having over a fair budgeting process. So not to be gloom and doom, but we can't neglect what's going on here, too.
I meant to ask you before we go, and I wanted to ask you earlier, but I slipped my mind, the H1N1.
Yeah.
The vaccines, are they now? You represent a lot of medical workers and a lot of responders and so on, right?
Yep.
How are they reacting to this? This vaccination? Are they resisting it, or are they getting great pressure from their employers?
We represent so many different kinds of workers who have to deal with this, from school nurses and town sanitarians to correction officers. And if there's one shared element, there's a deep concern about H1N1, and there's a deep concern about having the resources to help vaccinate people and allocate whatever scarce resources.
But I meant, is there any fear by these people about
the safety of the vaccination?
In terms of the safety of the vaccination itself?
Yeah, I think not.
I mean, I think the people we represent are trying to make sure that they have to live within the rules and the structures that are getting created. So I don't think they're questioning the fact that we're starting to vaccinate people. Their concern is to make sure that people do what's necessary, whether it's as simple as washing your hands, staying home when you're sick, to getting a vaccination for your children if it's necessary. We have school nurses who tell me that, and Lila can relate to this, that school nurses have become like the first stop in the healthcare system.
That's right.
Because parents don't have insurance,
that's
or they're
right.
uninsured,
or
they can't
work.
Afford it, their company doesn't give them sick time.
Terrible.
So the bigger problem with H1N1 isn't going to be the vaccination itself. It's the fact that people aren't able to stay home from work, and that they're sending their kids to school sick, and they're sending themselves to work sick because they simply don't have a whole lot of other options. So that's how things become. That's how things spread. But if there's concern about the vaccination, I'm not quite seeing that. I'm seeing concern about how to allocate the resources and how to educate people to try to take care of themselves and to be sick and to stay home and stay out of contact, and maybe to have paid sick leave laws so that people can stay home.
That'd be good. Well, we've come to the end of our time quickly.
Yep. Thanks.
Appreciate it. And we'll talk to you soon.
Talk soon. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Larry. Okay, bye-bye. That was Larry Dorman talking to us about healthcare, about the H1N1, about the state of the economy. And Larry is the public affairs coordinator for AFSCME Council 4.
Yeah.
So let's get on.
So we come to the end of our show.
Okay, and I want to thank everybody for listening to that. I hope you enjoyed that and got something out of it. To follow up on that, you can always check the archive. If you didn't hear the whole thing or the whole show tonight, you can check the archives. also, you can go to council4.org, and that's that's Larry's union's, the AFSCME union website in Connecticut, but it also links to the AFL-CIO and AFSCME's major websites. So I want to thank you, and please join us tomorrow when we venture into the spirit world. And so tomorrow at 8 o'clock. So thank you, and have a pleasant evening.